Hey everybody, it's Brendan. Look, we had a pretty good show lined up for you this week. It was actually really good. We had Barack Obama on the show, but unfortunately, Felix spilled a grape knee high on my laptop, and we lost this one. So we're in a tight spot. Everyone's busy, and they can't record today, but luckily, I have been producing this show for a pretty long time. And by now, I can basically, act out everyone's shtick almost by rote. So, what I'm going to try to do is basically fill in for the gang here. I've got all their mics set up where they usually sit, and I'm just going to channel them. And, yeah. I think this is doable. Hello, friends. It's Chapo. It's this week's Chapo. Chapo, let's go. It's me, Will Meneker, your host. I'm the main one. And with me, Felix Biberman.
Yeah, that reminds me how Saudi Arabia is like when you leave your protein powder at the gym, and then you're playing GTA, and that's like Salafism.
And Matt Chrisman.
Oh, I'm so mad. Oh, God, I can't stand prestige TV. Why does all the TV have to be so good? Bullshit.
Also joining us is Amber.
I found a bat on the subway. I'm gonna take it home, even though it's covered in rabies. Oh,
and Virgil, Texas. Yes, I'm getting hungry. Can we can we call the Crown Fried Chicken in Newark? That's the one I like. I won't eat any other food. Oh, now my tummy hurts. Oh, I don't want any food. Never mind. Now I have to go to sleep. Oh. So this week, we've got some news and a reading series, and it's all here on Chapo. I'll try to talk directly into the mic, even though I usually forget, and then Brendan has to do even more work, keeping the levels balanced, sometimes taking him up to 2 hours just to edit one episode. Oh, there's the theme song, another thing Brendan has to do. Good. Let's make sure none of the fan art includes him, by the way. He doesn't deserve to be represented, since he's not, technically flapping his fucking gums on the air every second of every show. Every single show. I've been on well, so yeah. Stay tuned for Trapo Chap House. Fuck. Look, I flubbed the line. Okay, great. That's another thing I guess Brendan's gonna have to fix. Good, good. Another thing for Brendan to fix. Pathetic.
Greetings, friends. It's time for Chapo. Let's do the roll call. It's me, Will Meneker. Felix Biederman.
Hello, everyone.
Virgil, Texas.
Hi.
Matt Chrisman.
Sup, folks.
Joining us this week is the single most prolific Chapo guest in our now almost year-long history, President Davison. I'm talking about Derek Davison, folks. How you doing?
Hi, sweeties. How are you?
President Davison is the official Chapo foreign policy correspondent, and we wanted to have you on to discuss one of the Trump administration's key advisors that we've spent a lot of time learning about this week, and combines a lot of the same sort of strange Lovian buffoonery with actual real frightening evil in a way that's very indicative of the world we live in now. But before we get on to that topic, I would just like to use this opportunity to personally apologize to Derek for being inadvertently rude to him when I met him in DC a month ago. Derek, forgive me.
I don't even know what you're talking about.
This was mere hours after the Boss Burger fiasco. I was in a shitty mood at the Sam's party after the inauguration, And, you know, I came over and you were talking to Matt, I think, and you said, hey, what's up? And I was like, yeah, hey, what's going on? And you were like, I'm Derek. And I was like, oh, that's cool, man. I was like, oh, wow, great. Another male fan of the show. I'm real glad to be talking to this guy. And then Matt was like, you asshole, this is Derek Davison, the guy we've interviewed on the show. No, you said, you know, I'm Derek, the guy you've interviewed three times before. And I was like, oh, great to meet you. Wonderful to meet you.
You know that the guests from the show think you've gone fucking batshit?
You're sitting there with your robe like John Barrymore.
You're hitting your fucking vape pen.
Anyway, I should,
in your defense, I should say that, like, I wasn't, even when I was of this sort of age where going to a house party was age appropriate, I wasn't any good in that environment. So, now that I am far too old for such things.
This is an example of
I think it's
even
it
worse.
It just showed Will's true colors.
Yeah.
The man, I mean, he's one of those fake friends. Yeah.
I've let my infinitesimal micro celebrity immediately go to my head.
Go to your head, yeah.
I think I'm better than everyone now.
I just want to say that I'm very happy to be back. My stint as Michael Rapaport's foreign policy guru did not go well. So I'm glad to be back on the show, frankly.
Yeah, on your LinkedIn, it now says Derek Davison, foreign policy advisor. Whole style, comma, chump.
That's actually Sebastian Gorka's security clearance. Chump.
That's what the Secret Service call him. Yeah. Now, I would like to just note that for the rest of this interview, we will be referring to Sebastian Gorka as Sebastian Goku. So yeah. For listeners, that's just, you know.
That's a legal thing.
Yeah. By virtue of introducing Mr. Goku, I want to read this anecdote that was in a recent Washington Post profile of him. It says here, hold on a second. It talks about just 3 days after Trump's election, Gorka addressed the cheering room of people who had helped pave the way his way to the halls of power. The audience consisted mostly of retirees who had gathered at the Breakers Hotel in Palm Beach, Florida. They were Gorka admirers, regular people, deeply afraid of terrorism and eager to listen to a man whose frightening insights would soon be receiving a hearing at the highest levels of U.S. government.
They were real Gorka fans, not those fake Gorka girls.
Yeah, they were behind Gorka from the beginning, man, not just after he sold out to Trump. They've been there the whole time.
I have been camping outside the Quiznos, that's also a war college, for 3 weeks waiting to hear Gorka speak. I actually wrote a song that's just Eminem Stan, but about Gorka. Dear Sebastian, you still ain't call a road. I ain't mad. I just think it's fucked up that you don't want to invade Pakistan.
These are the people who've been with him since the beginning, when they were all doing World War II reenactments as the Einsatzgruppe. Yeah.
Sebastian, now that you're big, never forget your friends from the Boer War Revisionism Dinner Party Society.
Yeah, again, imagine this scene at this, you know, the Breakers Hotel, you know, Palm Beach, Florida, like, hotel dining room, and this guy's addressing the crowd. You know, now basically the world's swinging from his nuts on top of it all. Look at me, Ma. He says, I'm accused by many people of being the most serious man on television, Gorka said in his plummy British accent.
Absolutely.
Yeah, he's accused of that all the time.
Yeah. I see him and I'm like, wow, this guy may mean too much business.
He's too serious, but he says, today it might be a little different. I'm in a different mood.
How many of y'all like sex?
well, he goes on, he says, today I'm going to start with something a tad naughty. He feels cheeky. He's in a good mood. He moved through the crowd of people who had paid up to $1,500 to hear him speak. We are happy, right? We are happy, he said. Well, shit, you know, if you just spent, you know, $1,500 to see Gorka, you know, I bet you'd be happy. There were nods and quiet applause as Gorka fished around in his pocket of his yellow blazer, searching for his remote. I'm going to show a picture. I am not meant to show usually, he said. Just bringing up the DMs as he searched his Twitter DMs frantically. He said he paused to draw out the suspense before pressing the remote's button. Up popped a photograph of a dead, bloodied, brown-skinned man lying on the ground next to an AK-47 assault rifle. The audience began to cheer, first hesitantly, then with gusto. Gorka's booming voice filled the room. "We can win now," he thundered. "We can win."
Jesus Christ. Now, this is 100% real.
This is Sebastian Gorka, 100% clean PowerPoint presentation. Clean snuff film PowerPoint presentation. But yeah, so like, that's an anecdote that I think is a good introduction to Sebastian Gorka, Goku, whose career I think is sort of a template for a lot of the people who now find themselves in the Trump administration at the height of power in the executive branch, of being sort of on the fringes of academia and even foreign policy circles for years, but then finding a kind of rich benefactors who sort of plug them into these, you know, war colleges and these lecture circuits and Fox News, to eventually catching the eye of Steve Bannon and becoming deputy assistant to Donald Trump, the president. So, Derek, what can you tell us about Goku's like worldview? I mean, were you familiar with this guy before, or did you just find out about him now?
The first I really read about him was when a reporter named Eli Clifton, who writes for Loblog, reported that on his decision to wear this, you know, Nazi collaborator medal from Hungary to one of the inaugural balls, and I guess he was photographed. You know, he's in this bizarre kind of formal uniform looking thing that doesn't, it just makes the whole picture worse.
I know, it's disgusting. But he was stealing Aerocross Valor.
Yeah. Sir, who is your blimp commander?
So he was wearing a Vitezi Rend medal, which is commemorates a group that, you know, did collaborate with the Nazis. You know, they're listed by the State Department as one of the groups, you know, one of the Eastern European groups that, you know, collaborated with the Nazis in World War II. You know, he wrote this piece about, you know, why is this person wearing this medal? And Gorka responded to it on Breitbart. I guess he was interviewed or something on their public access TV feed. And said that he was wearing it because his father had been in this group, and it was his father's medal, and he was commemorating his father's brave fight against communism or some.
Well, it does mention in the Washington Post article that his father was arrested and tortured by the secret police and the communist secret police in Hungary before he was born and before he fled to England.
And deserved every second of it.
And so, I mean, you can certainly, you can certainly understand being proud of your father and being proud of the fact that he was a political prisoner or whatever, you know, whatever is going on in Gorka's head about that. But at the same time, I mean, you know, wearing the medal of a Nazi collaborator is not, has a message apart from I'm really proud of my dad for getting this medal. Like, it carries other implications.
Look, I'm sorry, but I am not going to apologize for honoring my grandfather, who was executed by the Soviets just for a little misunderstanding at a camp that he ran in Poland. Okay? I'm not going to forget the injustice of him being hung by quote unquote a war crimes tribunal.
My grandfather was from
communists.
The working class. He was a butcher of a certain kind, actually.
You realize that my grandfather fought for your fucking freedom and for the melted down gold that's in your engagement ring right now. Now, Goku isn't like the first. He's not the first Trump guy who has ties to a fascist group. I mean, I thought it was funny during the first few months of the general election campaign when we found out about Walid Faris, who was kind of one of the authors of the original Muslim ban plan. He was not just a member of Lebanese forces, Katyeb, but he was like a commander-ranked guy.
Right.
But Goku, like, all those guys have kind of been pushed off to the side, but Goku has, like, a pretty high-ranking position compared to the other fucking freaks that have been on board on the Trump thing.
And, you know, when you read about him, and, like, the thing that comes across in the Washington Post article in describing his worldview and, you know, like, this kind of being on the fringes of academia, shall we say, the thing that they make clear is that, like, unlike, you know, the sort of old, like, the Bush and then Obama administration, like, his big hobby horse is Islam. And not just, like, studying Islam, but just being very open about what he regards as the need to, for instance, say the phrase radical Islamic terrorism.
And right, he's one of the magic words guys. Like,
he's one of the magic words guys, but he believes, just he genuinely believes, that nobody in the U.S. intelligence community really understands Islamic radicalism, and they don't understand it because, in his view, they refuse to understand that it is solely about religion, and that if you, like, the instructions for being a terrorist are in the Quran, and if you read and believe the Quran, then, like, that is what causes you to be a terrorist. So, like, how do you see, like, that view being reflected in the sort of new Trump foreign policy, if at all?
Well, okay, so, I mean, he's very much in keeping with the Michael Flynn and Steve Bannon view of Islam as the root of the problem. One of the interesting things that's, you know, since he's gotten a little bit of attention, you know, first for the medal and then, you know, for telephoning his critics and, you know, threatening to sue them for criticizing him, basically, people have started to examine his past work. And so, you know, naturally, when somebody presents themselves as a doctor, as he does, like, insufferably so, you know, people have checked out his dissertation. And, you know, his dissertation was on transcendental terrorism. So basically his argument is that, right, I know, right? So in the post-Cold War, like, he's distinguishing between, you know, the kind of terrorists that you can reason with and the kind that are just looking for the end of the world. Like, people who have clear political aims and are using terrorism in the service of those aims versus the Al-Qaeda types and the, you know, now ISIS types. I mean, he wrote his dissertation in 2007.
For our listeners of the show, this is sort of imagine the difference between Bane and the Joker.
Right, exactly. Exactly.
I'm actually looking at a diagram that was included in his dissertation. And it's a very snazzy piece of infographic here. It's an arrow.
It's just the line. Yeah,
it's just
a
line. It's just one arrow going one way. On the other end, it says peacekeeping. And on the other end, it says thermonuclear war. And underneath it is just terrorism with question marks around it.
Like, and a line. Like, it's somewhere in here. Somewhere between peacekeeping and thermonuclear war is terrorism. And we don't know where. But, you know, he definitely established that it was on the spectrum somewhere, which, you know, excellent academic work. The interesting thing about his dissertation, one of the interesting things about his dissertation, aside from how shoddy it is that like he's much more measured in his dissertation about, you know, we want to be careful not to alienate Muslims by, you know, casting a wide net and talking about Islam as the problem. And so somewhere between 2007 and now, in the last decade, he's decided either he's had a sort of organic reawakening and decided that Islam is the problem, or, and I suspect this is closer to the truth, he's come to understand that saying that Islam is the problem is a good way to get yourself in with some of the far-right money men in the Republican Party and on the, you know, the right fringe, and, you know, make a career for yourself.
Wait a minute. He wasn't able to make a career for himself with his degree from the Hollywood Upstairs War College?
He is sort of the Dr. Nick Riviera of counterterrorism.
Yeah. He is. I mean, you know, he's like this low-rent guy. I mean, the comment, almost every profile I've read of this guy now, and there have been a bunch, you know, as his profile has gotten raised, almost every one of them includes some variation of, you know, when you talk to terrorism experts and ask them about Sebastian Gorka, the first thing they say is, who's that? I never heard of him before. So, he didn't have any real name for himself until he hitched his wagon to Trump.
Yeah, he made a bunch of ads where it's like, this ugly son of a bitch is saying radical Islamic terrorism, and you're basically fucking dumb.
Terrorism experts hate him. As terrifying as it is to see these absolute slavering idiots and con men and warmongers in the White House, there's a certain sick enjoyment of imagining how much it must piss off liberals who worship at the altar of meritocracy to see a bunch of dudes like degrees that they made at Kinko's in the White House, you know? And they're like, yeah. They didn't go to Harvard. Where's their degree? Like, no, bitch. Fuck you. Jared Kushner is in there in every fucking meeting. The guy who had to pay $2.5 million to go to Harvard.
We were just talking before this about how, like, John Schindler is always like, this is the worst team of assholes and crooks and Russian agents. And it's like, well, you thought you were going to be in there.
Yeah.
And it's just like, no, they just picked a different asshole with no qualifications and a personality issue.
I'm still
issue.
Really bummed that Michael Flynn Jr. was too committed to tweeting about Pizzagate to accept a security clearance and a job at the White House, because that would have ruled so hard.
I mean, one of the things that comes up, you mentioned before about how he maybe was in his dissertation more tempered, and then like the sort of the more apocalyptic cast of mind he was adopted or willing to speak about, like for instance on Fox News and on Breitbart, the sort of the hotter his career got, because he sort of provides. He says the things that other idiots want to hear, they talking about how there's the guy who became sort of his I guess like mentor or sugar daddy or whatever is this guy named Thomas Saunders III, who is a major Republican Party donor and chairman of the Conservative Heritage Foundation, and it talks about how when those ISIS videos came out of them burning that pilot alive, he got Gorka to come speak to him and his like groups of fellow rich idiots in New York City, and they just wanted to ask him, why would they do this? Why is there so much barbarism in the world? And of course he told them that they're like this because, you know, their religion made them that way, which is, maybe not completely incorrect, but I mean, like, his understanding of the world and religion is, paper thin.
Yeah, I mean, it's like, there is some merits to the fact that the moon god does command them to kill.
But, the thing is that there's a reason that these guys are able to make hay with this simplistic nonsense, because people want to hear it, A, because it exculpates them and it makes them feel like they're like the good side in a Manichean battle of good versus evil, but also it's a clear, concise explanation for what the hell is going on. And it's Islam is bad. These people want to kill us because they have a bad religion and we need to stop them. And you know what? As wrong as that is, it is coherent in a way. And Jonathan Schwartz wrote something for The Intercept along these lines this week that was really good. Is that what is the liberal counter to that? How do they explain terrorism? Because they can't confront the reality of America's role in the Middle East and its imperial policy and the horrible bloodshed that's carried out in the last 30 years. So they're left just saying, no, Islam is a religion of peace and terrorists hijack it for some reason. We don't know why. They're just bad people. I mean, it's not any closer to the truth than the idea of Islam as a foundationally evil religion, but it doesn't even make sense. It's its own merits. It doesn't even have internal consistency in the way that the shit these guys are slinging does. So, of course, any mediocrity can just parrot this because it's easy and it's what people want to hear, and it makes sense in its own on its own terms.
When we had a Republican president who didn't, who rightly, understood that blaming Islam was a bad idea, we had to talk about how they hate us for our freedoms. Which is, again, just bullshit that you say because you don't want to confront the legacy of what America has done in that part of the world.
Well, and that's
and
the other
boy,
thing.
My boy Matt Iglesias had a perfect fucking example of this, where he said he was in the course of making a case that we shouldn't be rehabilitating Bush. He was a bad president, But he did a few things right. And one of them was he was good on Islamophobia, by which he meant that in his public statements he did not blame Islam for terrorism. But, of course, a lot of people were like, you idiot, he invaded Iraq. That wasn't Islamophobic.
Yeah.
No, it wasn't Islamophobic necessarily, but invading Iraq creates the kind of horror and bloodshed and spawns things like ISIS that lead people to make the conclusion, since we can't talk about U.S. imperialism as a cause for violence in the Middle East, leads them to think, oh, it must be Islam.
I mean, with this sort of NatSec bullshit, you do see... You see the defining moment of our – the defining problem of our age, which is that the liberal consensus, their lack of providing answers has created this gap. But the only people who go through that gap, who provide the answers, are fucking cranks like Donald Trump, like Sebastian Gorka, like Michael Flynn, people who rightfully see this fucked up state of the world. You know, with terrorism, it's very obvious what's happening. There's this combination of – interests between America, Saudi Arabia, and Israel that does create a shitload of chaos both in the Middle East and in countries that are in proximity to regional enemies of all three powers. That, you know, they definitely, these groups definitely have historically and do exploit hardline terrorist groups. It's pretty fucking obvious. But because this goes up against the superstructure, you have to say these platitudes that you don't really mean. Whether it's like, well, you know, sir, if you read the fucking Quran, or if it's you know, Iran is actually the biggest exporter of terror globally. Just all this bullshit. Even though you look at the world, you look at all these fucking guys from JAN meeting in Turkey with their Saudi money men. You look at the fucking Jandala group from Balochistan and their Israeli contacts. You look at the Israeli-Turkish fucking field hospital for jihadist fighters in Syria, and you go, well, something totally different seems to be going on. But when you have that total gap between reality and what the consensus declares reality to be, the thing that emerges through the gap is a guy with a fucking Entenmann's donut for a goatee who got his degree in a massage parlor.
But Derek, I want to ask you, like you know, we brought up George W. Bush, and you know, and when I remember, you know, when he was in power, I'm like, it was portrayed that, like, you know, the neoconservatives that rode to power with George W. Bush and took over the U.S. foreign policy establishment, and of course invaded Iraq and probably wanted to invade Iran were they given half a chance. That they represented like a split with like the previous foreign policy establishment and consensus. And then, you know, Obama came in and was thought of as being, you know, sort of like the smart guy president who would basically avoid ground wars but massively expand surveillance of terrorist networks and drone strikes and things like that. So like there, I guess there's some continuity, there's some fissures between these executive branches, but it's been a short time, but like, what, if anything, do you regard like is as different about the Trump administration's handling of foreign policy?
It's the chaos. You know, as critical as you could be of U.S. foreign policy over the last, you know, however many decades you want to go, and I would join you in all your criticism probably. There's something to be said at least for an administration, an American government that isn't so obviously floundering for a coherent message, that has, you know, the president just saying whatever shit comes to his head in a press conference, for example, with, you know, Benjamin Netanyahu. You know, one state, two state, I don't know, whatever they want.
69 states. That's like, a nice number of states.
That's you know, that's new, and it's not good. You know, one of the things that, you know, people who were trying, I think, to find a silver lining to Trump's election talked about before he took office was, you know, he's not going to be wedded to these foreign policy orthodoxies that have been, you know, have not served America very well over the past, you know, let's say 20 years, could be more than that. But, you know, that can cut both ways. I mean, that could be a good thing, could be a bad thing. And so far, it's been a very bad thing because he's not wedded to anything. I mean, it's not that he's not wedded to these, you know, orthodoxies. He's not wedded to anything. And so that's when you, that's why you get, you know, statements that come out of this White House that have to be immediately contradicted by, you know, the UN ambassador, Nikki Haley, or the, you know, well, I would say the Secretary of State, but I don't even know that Rex Tillerson has met Donald Trump since he got the job.
there was a video that Benny Johnson did at the Trump Steakhouse in D.C. They had dinner next to each other.
Right. He was there, but he wasn't there with Trump. He was just there with his wife.
No, Tillerson's the biggest cuck of the administration. My favorite thing about that of like these people having to clean up for Trump is when they sent Mattis to Iraq. To reassure them that we're not going to try to take the oil, whatever the fuck that means. Because
right. I mean, how bad? Mattis has been on the road.
We're going to take the oil. We're going to get a giant metal straw and stick it in
there. Suck the oil out of the ground.
We're going to drink their milkshake. So he has to go to Iraq and say, when the president says this, don't listen to him. He's an insane, senile moron.
And there's Mattis.
Like, oh, that's reassuring. Thanks.
That's right. I mean,
better about that fact.
Exactly. You know, Mattis has been on the road for, you know, most of the first, you know, month and a half or whatever it's been of this administration. He's been traveling from place to place, basically telling people, you know, don't worry about it. Yeah, he didn't mean it. He didn't mean it. Don't worry about it. Everywhere he goes. I mean, he went to the Gulf and had to do that. He went to Iraq. He had to do that. He went to Europe and had, you know, when he says, you know, fuck NATO, he doesn't really mean it. He doesn't really mean it. We still like NATO. And
I mean, I would rather,
this is
I would
unprecedented.
Like, hey,
I mean, these are the people who were so far up Obama's ass over this so-called apology tour that he took. And you have the Secretary of Defense who is literally on an apology tour, apologizing to every fucking place on the planet. I'm sorry. Sorry. He's sorry. He's trying to remove it. He's trying to remove it.
I mean, I would be much – if I was one of these – any of these other leaders, I would much rather – think this guy has bad views. He wants to destroy our alliance, or he wants to steal our oil somehow. He wants like to send the Hamburglar over to steal our oil. Sack with an oil derrick drawn on the side. But at least I could like, okay, this is a guy with views, and I could deal with him instead of being told by the guy's own Secretary of State, yeah, don't worry. Your biggest ally, your most important ally, the leader of the most powerful country in the world, is essentially his brain is dying.
Right, yeah, right. And it's run by, you know, senile syphilitic. It's worse. I mean, it is worse. You know, so that's the thing so far to me that separates this administration is just that it's been a fucking mess. I mean, there's no consistency. There's no, you know, as Matt said, you can even if you elected a guy who has, you know, abhorrent foreign policy views, if he was consistent about them, then the rest of the world could adjust. But when you elect a guy who, you know, literally doesn't know what he's going to say from one minute to the next, and when you're running for president and you do that, that's one thing. But when you are the president of the United States, you know, every word that comes out of your mouth on the subject of geopolitics, on anything really, but especially on foreign policy, has weight. You know, people react to it in real time. I mean, they make, you know, they have to change, you know, other countries have to adjust to whatever American policy seems to be. And right now it's just, you know, from one minute to the next, you don't know anymore what American policy is.
How bad do you have to fuck up in Iraq that you fuck up so bad that the guy you send over to clarify things committed war crimes in that country like 8 years ago? And that's the guy they're happy to see. They're like, oh, the guy who we've named 12 mass graves in Fallujah after is here to reassure us. This is, okay, good.
Hey, everybody, it's old.
It's Mad
James
Dog.
Yeah.
It's Mad Dog.
Uranium Mattis over here. Call me DP.
Derek, so how long can this unstable situation go on? Because from where I'm sitting, it's almost a comforting thought that the administration is so inept and will just spin its wheels for so long that they won't be able to put into practice any of the nefarious evil things that the people want to do in the administration.
I mean, I think it's going to take some time, and if we all live through that time, it'll be okay. But it's going to take some time for the rest of the world, and, you know, I mean, like the EU and the GCC, China, you know, it's going to take time for these other powers, not maybe on the level of the United States, but to say, okay, you know, we can't, we have to figure out how to operate in a world where the United States is, you know, just kind of lurching from one thing to the next and doesn't know, you know, where it's going to be next week. I think that's possible. I think that can happen, but it's going to take a little while, and it's going to be a tense period, I think, for a while.
I do think that one cherished orthodoxy that will hopefully be destroyed by the Trump presidency is the idea that the presidential office is this, not only this storehouse of respectful, it's a respectful institution with this storehouse of tradition and blah, blah, blah. Obviously, that's done for, you know. But also the idea that it's an incredibly important job, that it, you're like the linchpin of the global order. Because if you can have a president who doesn't have object permanence for 4 years and the country is still standing, I honestly think that they shouldn't run someone against Trump in 2020. They should run on the idea of abolishing the office. Because, like, what? It's obviously not that important. We've kind of sold you a bill of goods that this job is that important and has to have all these powers and has to have all of this secrecy because of all of these responsibilities. No, the guy's like, he's playing Angry Birds. The job is, come on, get rid of it.
Right. I mean, like, if you can imagine a scenario, and I know this is, we're basically in science fiction territory, but where the Democratic Party gets its shit together enough to win control of Congress in 2018, because, I mean, it wouldn't be the Democrats getting their shit together so much as this guy just fucking up so comprehensively. But you could almost imagine a very needed rebalancing of the roles of president and Congress on issues of national security and foreign policy. You know, that would require, you know, not just the electoral success, but it would require Democrats, you know, finally deciding that the imperial presidency is not the way to go, and they've happily been a part of creating the imperial presidency. So, you know, it would require a lot of changes on their part.
But they won't. It won't happen because they think the White House is just theirs for the taking in 2020.
It doesn't matter how many times they lose it. It doesn't matter how dumbly they lose it. It doesn't matter how many people tell them that their candidates are fucking uninspiring garbage. They're kind of like Mac and Always Sunny in that they think they're always gonna fuck the rich suburban housewife. And they just never, ever, ever fucking do.
That's Chuck Schumer was like, every white working class voter we lose, we're going to fuck two suburban housewives in the Philadelphia suburbs.
First of all, Representative Ellison, I do not have fucking glamour muscles. These are combat muscles.
Joining us now from Washington, Deputy Assistant to the President, Dr. Sebastian Gorka. Dr. Gorka, before we get to that, you know, like Reince, like Bannon, like Jared, like Ivanka, like the President's children, like Kellyanne, like Steve Miller, you too have come under fire. It seems that there is this Alinsky-style attack against anybody that's around the President. And, you know, I just wanted to give you a chance to respond because I know you're being attacked unfairly. And I read a number of things about your involvement as a witness in the Boston Marathon case and even people suggesting you're a Nazi sympathizer. What is your reaction?
I think we're doing our job very well, don't you, Sean, if this is the best they can do. I was talking today to the acting U.S. attorney in Boston who said, we're so sorry about what's happening, and we're going to make sure that everybody who reports on your part in the trial as an expert is going to do so accurately from now on.
I don't know what's down to that shit. In my day, we did plenty of fighters, but they didn't make me go around chopping me head off. That's not a shame.
Derek, I do want to check in. We want to do a sort of a check-in on some of our favorite spots around the world. But just to sort of bring things full circle with Goku again, I asked you like about this sort of where are these sort of fractures and continuities between, you know, the last two administrations and their visions of foreign policy. And the thing that strikes me about whether it's Gorka or any of these other like, you know, cretins and weirdos who are now just literally tripped over their dicks into like some of the most powerful positions in the executive branch. It's like they have the same Manichaean and apocalyptic cast of mind about the West and the rest of the world and the need for American power as all of the neoconservatives in the Bush administration. And I believe Gorka was even quoted, gave a quote to a reporter right after the election where he literally said, "The alpha males are in charge again." And, you know, who was one of the big intellectual influences on the neoconservative movement? Harvard's Harvey Mansfield, who literally teaches a class on how to be an alpha male. It's just the only difference now is that, like, all that intellectual pedigree is just completely gone. And it's the same people who believe the same dumb shit, but none of them went to Harvard and Yale. They went to the Hungarian upstairs war college. So it's like these same neoconservative beliefs, but filtered through people who are fucking, you know, who like, have, you know, tomato sauce stains on their shirts.
Well, I mean, isn't the difference... The difference really doesn't come down to bellicosity... the desire to see some sort of world historical clash to destroy evil, so much as the tactical way of going about it. They basically are skeptical of the transnational institutions that that neoconservatism, when it was convenient, kind of wants to lean on and kind of want to reorientate, right? Like, the Bannon idea is to sort of bring back the pre-World War I great powers and, like, sort of have them allied along racial awareness lines, basically. Like, all the white countries sort of on the same side, as opposed to some sort of world order based on like, markets.
I mean, I think that's right. I think you're in the right direction. The feeling is, you know, instead of... For the neoconservatives, the emphasis was, you know, we need to defeat terrorism militarily, but also by, you know, lifting the poor downtrodden, you know, mud peoples up with our freedom and democracy, and we can you know, enable them to, you know, rise up out of the primitive, what I mean, this is the attitude, right? Sort of the white man's burden theory of history, versus, you know, I think what the Frank Gaffneys and Sebastian Gorkas and the Steve Bannons of the world feel like, we just need to fucking dominate these people. Like, all the white countries need to gang up and, you know, run the world like fucking colonial, you know, 19th century shit. And that's how you win. So I think it's not a difference of, you know, necessarily what is the problem, but it is a difference in terms of how do we the, you know, the great and powerful United States, leader of the world, deal with it? You know, do we empower what neoconservatives would call, you know, would say is empowering people with the tools of the wonderful Western civilization, or do we just, you know, fucking you know, stomp on these guys?
That's one worldview, okay? A previous worldview that has fallen out of fashion and it is now trying to reassert itself. We talked briefly about this before we started recording, but can we talk a little bit about Tony Blair popping up again?
Yeah. So
his defense of Blairism again,
denying, and if you get to the point where you have to deny it, then you got a problem. So he's denying reports that he's been trying to pitch himself to Jared Kushner as Donald Trump's Middle East envoy, which would basically make him Kushner's deputy.
This is the greatest day of my life.
That would be, I want that to happen so bad, because, like, that would be such a good sitcom.
That's the best punishment for war crimes, is not that you go to The Hague, but you have to get coffee for a profoundly retarded building developer. Who's, like, the most important foreign policy guy in the wet clay brain guy's administration. Like, you're responsible, you're partly responsible for, like, easily over a million deaths, but for the next 5 years of your life, it's just, all you hear is, I don't like skim milk in the latte. Tony, is Pakistan one of the Aladdin countries?
But yeah, no, you know, Tony is trying to pitch what he sees as, you know, how the West is being pulled apart by populism on the right and left, and we need a reassertion of what he calls the progressive vital center. Yeah. Yeah, no, I mean, I guess if you wanted to pitch that, getting Jared Kushner's ear would be the place to start, as he is now the America's Middle East guy.
Yeah, well, I mean, he's the shadow Secretary of State. That was, you know, one of the many articles that have recently been written about, you know, how Rex Tillerson has been absolutely thoroughly cucked. You know, said it's Kushner. I mean, Kushner's the guy that runs the foreign policy for this administration.
You know what's so awesome about Tillerson, by the way? He's probably the least dumb guy in the entire administration, but they've given him the department, which has been strategically cucked by every administration for the last 40 years. So he probably has like some evil 50-part plan to become president, but it's just going to get foiled one day when Trump like is like, I'm Zoroastrian because of something I saw on TV.
Well, I mean, he gets the job. Congratulations, you're Secretary of State. Oh, by the way, a week later, they say we want to cut your budget by 50%.
That's so awesome.
We want you to basically not have a State Department
so
anymore.
We can fund our military buildup. Yeah,
people get upset about that. I mean, obviously, that's an insane. I mean, that's like a cartoon teacot, you know, senile Fox News grandpa budget. It's not going to pass, though. People should relax a little bit. That's not going to be anything like the actual budget. Come on.
Yeah.
I remember when Obama was going to pass, like, going to cut ag subsidies and all that shit in 2009, and it never happened.
Our troops don't have the weapons that they need to win the war because they're buying too many dang pencils at the State Department. Yeah, cut their budget.
Yeah, I saw people at the State Department using their special diplomat EBT to buy candy. No more of that, folks.
This is how fucked the foreign policy debate in this country is. Like, you know, you have an actual administration now. I mean, it's always been this sort of joke that people think we spend like 80% of our budget on foreign aid, and really it's less than 1%. But you have an administration now that is in office that believes this shit. They're like, oh, if we just fucking cut foreign aid, you know, we can pay for flying submarines with plasma missiles on them. And fuck, man, we can just blow everybody up. No, I mean, it's nothing. The budget is nothing already, and you're going to cut it to less than nothing. Well, okay. I mean, good luck with that.
Well, I mean, that's the thing. It's like that is why Trump, talking about this again, how Trump really is the apotheosis of a bunch of trends in American life. And one of the biggest one as a result of sort of the mass production of culture that occurred in the 20th century is this cult of authenticity. Everybody rebelling against the sort of prefabricated world around them by seeking out what feels real. And then, of course, it was inevitable that that was going to enter the realm of politics. And that search for an authentic figure has reached its culmination, because Trump is the messiah of the cult of authenticity, because he is a Fox News grandpa. He's not, there's no artifice about it. There's plenty that's fake about him, but it's all fake in that wink at the camera reality show way that makes people smart for getting the joke. But then there's the other parts of him that are 100% real, like him just eating like chicken skins, you know, by the bucket load, and watching O'Reilly all night, and then being like, we got to cut this foreign aid damn budget. We got to get tough with the terrorists. It's like America's id just excreted out of its prick hole and became president.
Well, that's before all of America's $80 trillion in foreign aid gets cut, and we can't do anything in the world anymore. Let's take a little trip around the world, or around one part of the world. And I want to, Derek, check in with you on a few locations and people we've talked about before. So this is where in the world is Chapo fucking Trap House. No, let's start in Turkey with our boy Erdogan. We haven't talked about this in a while, but he's coming up on he's got a big date coming up soon, right, Derek?
Right. He's got a referendum coming up. This one is in April. I get this confused with the Iranian election, which is in May, but this one's in April, and it's a constitutional referendum on changes that would strengthen the office of president, which coincidentally happens to be the office that Erdogan has now, and strengthens the office of president, which in Turkey's system right now is a ceremonial, mostly ceremonial office. And most of the real day-to-day power resides with the prime minister and the cabinet. So Erdogan was term limited, was a party thing, the Justice and Development Party, one of their reform platforms when they were running in the 2000s was, we're going to impose term limits on ourselves. So we can't serve for more than, I think it was 3 terms in parliament. And Erdogan served his 3 terms and, was prime minister. And there was some talk that he was going to continue, but he decided to honor the term limit and pull the reverse Putin, basically, and parachute himself over to the presidency. And now that he's president, he wants to change the constitution to really jack up the powers of that office so that he can, go back to legal. I mean, he still runs the country because he's Tayyip Erdogan, and nobody in the Justice and Development Party can take a piss, basically, without asking for his permission. But, he wants to make it legal and formal and constitutional by strengthening the office of president.
Derek, did you listen to our interview with PPG, aka Rashid, aka Brace, aka Piss Pig Granddad?
Yes, I did. I did listen to.
Now, in that interview, I mean, this is what I wanted to ask you. Like, we're assuming Erdogan is going to win this referendum.
Well, it's not clear. So,
not yet.
The polling has been very close. I mean, much closer than I think he would like. There have been a couple of polls that have showed the no vote actually ahead, and the ones that have showed the yes vote ahead, it's been by very, very close margin. There hasn't been a lot of – he hasn't pulled away.
Derek, which way are Snapchat moms swinging?
That's one that we'll have to – I don't even know if Erdogan allows Snapchat in Turkey. He's probably got it turned off.
What are you talking about? During the coup, he hopped on Snap to be like, "Hey, everybody, I'm still alive." puppy face, flowers.
There's always the possibility of. I mean, unless he gets these changes put in place, there's a possibility that people will turn on him, and it's sort of this informal system that he's set up where he is the final authority on everything. Will come apart because it has no basis in law. So I think even the slim chance that could happen is enough to get him to want to pass this. Oh, there you go, trying to please voter. Oh, okay. So what he's doing is not rewarding people for voting yes, but he's trying some desperate measures to boost the economy short term and to give people a little economic boost so they feel good about the government. Turkey's economy has been struggling for a little while now. They went through a really tough patch when they, after they shot that Russian plane down and Moscow cut off, a lot of economic ties. They've clawed that back, but there's still a bit of a struggle. And I think what he's been doing is trying some short-term measures to, boost people's economic fortunes so that they'll feel good going into the referendum.
Derek, I mean, I brought up the interview we did with Brace because he mentioned in that interview, and you sort of had to read between the lines a little bit, but he said, assuming that the referendum passes, this will be just like an absolute green light for Turkey in Syria. Now, what exactly do you think that will look like, or what was he really referring to there?
Well, it'll remove. See, I think, unfortunately, there's going to be a green light no matter how this referendum comes out because, he's right. If the referendum passes and Erdogan is really like legally the final, the final word on literally everything, Turkey can go in even harder into northern Syria than it already has and take the fight to the the Kurds in places like Manbij and the rest of Rojava, you know, without even having to worry about, you know, any sort of political repercussions. But what I think may happen if he loses the referendum is that he's going to go back to a very tried and true formula for Erdogan, which is to blame the Kurds and to escalate violence with the Kurds, and that'll be in Syria and
so,
in Turkey.
I mentioned it moving slightly over next door. By the way, everyone can talk about this topic, but Felix, Brendan, turn off his microphone. Syria, can you give us an overview of how everything, what's going on in Syria?
People are afraid to tell the truth about this thing.
Felix, stop talking. Take his mic away.
The most powerful creature in the jungle is the lion. And that remains true in the desert, if you know what I mean. Now, there's one true president of Syria. Do you guys know the Eminem song, The Way I Am? Well, imagine if it was Assad singing. And that's how I feel about it.
Derek, where do things stand in this Syrian ongoing just catastrophe of civil war in that country?
There's the three things that I think are worth noting about Syria is the flubbing of the peace talks. You know, we had this dual track thing going on now in Kazakhstan between Russia and Iran and Turkey, and then in Geneva with the UN and the US and everybody. And, you know, they still can't bring the government and the rebel negotiators into the same room with each other, basically. I mean, there's very little direct communication. Because, you know, the problem of what happens to Syria at the end of this war is still there. The rebels still don't want Assad to remain in any capacity. And Assad, who now, you know, basically owns the situation on the ground, you know, is not in a position where he needs to make any concessions. The storyline that has been interesting to me is to watch the Russians, who, you know, went very all in on Assad, you know, and saved his life, saved his government.
Yeah, they backed their client to the hilt.
Are now trying to play the role of neutral sort of peacemaker, and it's not going very well. It's a very hard transition to go from active participant in a war to, you know, we're just the great power negotiator, you know, we're the guarantor of peace. And, you know, it's not going very well. There's a ceasefire that is only interrupted by the fact that, like, nobody has stopped fighting in any way in any part of the country. And you still have, you know, it's like 10 towns and cities at least that are basically under siege. People are starving. They can't get aid in. It's still a very ugly situation. There's not that sort of acute nastiness or ugliness that we saw in Aleppo, but it's sort of this slow boiling, you know, 10 people were killed today, and, you know, we've got a town where people are eating leaves and grass to try and stay alive. So there's that part of things, and then there's the ISIS fight, which, you know, it has to do with when and how are we going, the United States and its whatever allies it decides to work with, going to attack Raqqa, which is coming eventually, but the Obama administration didn't have a great handle on this, and certainly the Trump administration doesn't have a great handle on it. How you engage proxies? Do you use the Kurds and risk, you know, pissing off Turkey? Do you use the Turks, who don't really have, like, geographically a way to get to Raqqa at this point without fighting somebody else to get there, without either fighting the government or fighting the Kurds? And, you know, their performance so far in places like al-Bab hasn't exactly inspired confidence that they can participate in Raqqa and be successful. You know, do you put more American soldiers on the ground? That's one of the things that the Trump people have started talking about, is, you know, maybe adding, you know, a few hundred more American soldiers to the mix to fight directly. But it's, you know, that's sort of stalled. It's been stalled for a while now because there's no consensus on how to do it, how to accomplish the mission.
Well, and, you know, going back to our our interview with PPG, I mean, the one thing is clear is that Raqqa is well defended, and whoever does it, it's likely to be a very, very fierce and intense battle.
Right. It's going to be an intense battle, and there's concern. You know, even if you were to somehow be able to remove Turkey from the equation, there's a concern that, you know, if the city winds up being occupied by Kurdish forces for an extended period of time, the people already living there are going to chafe under that because, you know, there's sort of traditional some enmity there. And so the ideal thing would be to have some kind of a mostly Arab force go in and liberate the city and occupy it. But there is no such thing at this point. There's the Arab component of the Syrian Democratic Forces, but nobody really knows how capable they are without...
Derek, when you just said right now there is no such Arab force, several just patches of Charles Lister's beard fell out and continue to be look even more mangy. Last but not least, you alluded to it briefly before. Iran, they got an election coming up too.
Yes, so they have a presidential election coming up. The first round, I think, is at the very end of April, and then the runoff will be in May.
What can you tell us about the candidates?
Hassan Rouhani, the incumbent, is vulnerable. If you look at polling, you know, he still polls around, you know, 60 to 70% popularity, but it's softened a lot because the Iranian economy is still struggling. People don't feel like they've gotten the full benefit from the nuclear deal, from the lifting of sanctions, and they blame the United States for that. They say that Washington has been deliberately obstructing, and, you know, a little bit. You know, some of it is sort of out of people's hands because oil prices are still low and things like that. But there's been some, you know, effort to and the Trump administration wants to do more to sort of impede Iran from getting the full benefit of the sanctions being lifted. And so his support, you know, if you break his support into people who strongly approve of his, you know, performance and people who, you know, kind of sort of somewhat approve of his performance, the percentage that strongly approve has declined quite a bit from, you know, let's say 2 years ago or even a year ago. So he's vulnerable, but there hasn't been yet a principalist, you know, one major principalist candidate who's arisen and agreed to run. There's a couple of guys. There's the mayor of Tehran, Mohammad Ghalibaf, who ran and was, you know, throttled basically by
Rouhani. He banned 64-ounce teas, right?
Right. Well, he was, you know, beaten very badly. He came in second to Rouhani in 2013, but you know, was a distant second. You know, he's talked about maybe running again. There's a cleric named Ibrahim Raisi, who's the head of the Mashhad, you know, mosque, which is a, you know, one of the major, or shrine, I should say, not mosque, which is one of the major religious sites in Iran. So Raisi's been talked about, and he would be a very actually high profile. He's been talked about as, you know, being a possible successor to Ayatollah Khamenei as supreme leader. So he's obviously a very, you know, well-regarded figure among Iranians and has a lot of cachet. But none of these people have actually said they're running. You know, they've talked about, especially like Raisi and Ghalibaf, who are the two, I guess, highest profile, have said they'll run if all the hardline, there's a lot of different principalist hardline parties, if they all sort of coalesce behind me, then I'll run. But, you know, they're not doing that yet. And the Iranian elections are very short, certainly relative to the 3 year long elections we have here. But it is getting a little late in the game for somebody to step up and really challenge Rouhani.
What about the Iranian General Brett Hawthorne? Qassem Soleimani.
Soleimani would win if he ran, but he's
already said
that he is happy to serve as a soldier. He has no interest in running.
He's definitely running, folks. Yeah. You're here first.
That's a bummer because I would really like to see a world leader wearing a North Face jacket at all times.
Yeah, he would be the only hype beast world leader.
I mean, if he does change his mind, I think he would absolutely win.
Well, on that inspiring note, I have to say, Derek, thank you for taking us on this journey around the world through foreign policies and foreign politics. Derek, it is always a pleasure. President Davison, I salute you, our foreign policy correspondent.
Salute, Derek.
Thanks, guys.
Felix is already eating a sandwich. We have to go.
I really wanted a place. They have marinated peppers in this one.
That looks
and
good,
fresh
dude.
Mozzarella,
All right, now I'm fucking hungry. This chicken parm is calling to me.
Oh,
boys.
All right, well, time to end it then. Wrap it up.
Always a pleasure. Cheers, guys.
Thanks, guys.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Just explain to me why you're putting those emails on a social media Twitter.
Well, again...
No, just answer the question.
So, to answer the question, I was highlighting my concerns about the fact that you are working in the White House. But
you're being connected to me by a National Security Council colleague, why would you react with your concerns when he's recommending you to me? How does that concern you? Why is that a reason of concern? I don't understand how Josh is connecting us is a problem for you. Is it because I didn't get back to you fast enough? Is that the reason? I mean, have we ever met?
No, we have not. As a matter of fact,
so why is there such vitriol pumping out of you constantly every day now? It's so strange. I look at your Twitter feed, once or twice a day, and again, it's half a dozen tweets about me, and I've never met you.
Wow, are you defeating jihad by monitoring or trolling my Twitter feed? I mean, honestly, to begin, you've called an American citizen and begun the conversation very confrontationally by accusing me of animus towards you, of which I'm attempting to explain there is no animus towards you. Let me finish.
I invite you to the White House Thursday for a cup of coffee, and you can bring all your evidence about why you have problems with me, and we'll discuss it over a cup of coffee. How's that? How friendly an offer is that?
Well, it would be friendly if you could give me 2 weeks, because you've caught me in the middle of preparing for a speech that I have to give next week.
All right, hang on. I'll open my calendar right now. Hold on. So, 2 weeks from now, 28th is 1 week.
Why don't we do this?
Wednesday the 8th is open in the afternoon. How about a 2 o'clock meeting at the White House? Does that work for you?
Well, I would need to have specifics about who else will be in attendance, because if you're planning on bringing the White House legal counsel, I'd be happy to
bring my
own along.
Just you and me.
Because you've already threatened a lawsuit.
If you really want to explain to me your problems, then let's just be the two of us in my office in the White House complex. How's that?